Greetings and salutations, friends. This is Michael Keaton, Vice President for Enrollment Management at Ursinus College. Welcome to the ALP.
Welcome to the ALP, the Admissions Leadership Podcast, a series of one-on-one conversations with people who have been climbing the leadership mountain in college admissions. Some are nearing the summit, some are already there, but how did they get there, and what can other climbers learn from their mindsets, habits, and experiences? I'm your host, Ken Anselman, VP for Enrollment Management at RHB, and with me today, as you heard, is my, can we say, old friend? I'm asking you.
Yes, we could say that. I was counting the years. Sorry.
And how long? It's been what, like 17 years? When did we do College Horizons out at UPS?
That was probably 2004 or 5-ish, I think.
Yeah, around that. Yeah, UPS. Not United Parcel Service, but University of Puget Sound, for folks that don't have all their acronyms squared away. It's been a while, but I remember we were working with all the students out there. We were talking before we got on the air, and I know you have I don't know if I could call it a fond memory of College Horizons, but I'm trying to remember. Do you remember why I jumped on the couch?
We were doing a skit, right? And you were playing Tom Cruise in the skit, and I don't remember what the greater purpose was, but it was something presumably to illuminate something about the college admission process, but you were playing Tom Cruise, and it was shortly after he had the famous or infamous moment where he jumped up and down on Oprah's couch while being interviewed by Oprah.
Oh, that's right. And we were there to educate the students at College Horizons. I'm sure to inspire them on like what not to do in a college interview or something
that's
like that.
Right.
I have no idea. So you've had quite a journey since then.
Yes. And before.
Fair enough. I'm curious. I'd like to start at the top. I mean, you've been in the role at Ursinus since last year, 2023?
January of 2023, yes.
January 2023. You picked a great time, you know? Nothing much going on right now, this year and your first year?
Yeah, pretty mellow. Business as usual.
Right. In fact, why don't we go back? You said, you know, there was quite a journey before College Horizons and up till now. When I look at your career, you've been at a bunch of different types of institution, bunch of different market positions. I think there's fertile ground for us to kind of go over what you've learned along the way, what's similar about those experiences, different about those experiences, but maybe take us from the start. Where did the origin story begin? And I'm not going to make any superhero references. I'm just going to steer clear of any Batman references, even though people probably had that pop into their heads. I know I was telling my family I was interviewing Michael Keaton today, and they thought I was talking to... You get this all the time, don't you?
I do. And it's always Batman. It's never, you know, the guy has been in a lot of movies. It's never before and after Batman, but never Johnny Dangerously or actually one guy in college who was from Woburn, Massachusetts. He called me Mr. Mum. So I always appreciated that he went with Mr. Mom, but he sounded like M-U-M when he said it because of his accent.
Right.
But I just appreciated that he's the one guy who referenced something besides Batman.
Yeah, Birdman. I mean, you know, and you're enjoying a bit of a heyday, probably. Have people ask you to do like the bring it hands, like Michael Keaton did at the Oscars?
And let me tell you something, Ken, that I know because I've had the name for 49 years. But the other Michael Keaton is older than me, but I've had the name longer. He was born Michael Douglas and changed his name to Michael Keaton because there was already the other Michael Douglas. So he changed it sometime in the 70s, and I can't remember exactly when, but I was born in the 70s, but he changed his name after I was born. So he copied me more than me copying him.
I'm guessing he knew what was about
most
to come
likely
with you. Right. He's like, I need to hitch my wagon to that star. Okay. Well, here we are. So you, let's go back to the origin. Before we got on the air, I was flexing my Marquette cap. We were talking a little bit about Syracuse basketball. Where did your origin story begin?
Sure.
As the admissions hero journey?
So
I'm going to keep rocking this metaphor for the whole
time. It does go back to Syracuse University, where I did both undergrad and grad school, and I thought I was going to be a professor. When I was in grad school, I studied speech communication. Now it's called communication and rhetorical studies, but I wanted to be a professor and had a great mentor named Professor John Adams, Dr. John Adams, and his wife had been an admission officer at Hamilton in a prior life. She's also was then and is now a professor, but she had been in admissions. And I wanted a break before going into a PhD program. I'd gone from nursery school through master's without any kind of break, but I loved college so much that I wanted to stay on a campus. So hearing about admissions, I had also previously, the summer before my senior year, I worked as an orientation leader for the university. So that was sort of an admissions type role, but just wanted to be based on a campus. And I had an uncle that lived in the Roxbury section of Boston. I had some friends from college that lived in Boston. I knew there were a ton of colleges there. So I came home for the summer after graduating, worked to save some money, and then moved to Boston without a job, temped for a few months at the downtown crossing subway operations area in Boston, in a, typing up memos for the chief of Green Line and Red Line operations.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it was at a place that had the big subway map on the screen. If you remember the movie War Games, some of your Gen X listeners may remember that movie where they have the big map. That's what it looked like, except for it was the Boston subway system. And then I found an ad in the Boston Globe for an admission counselor role at Wentworth Institute of Technology, which I hadn't heard of at the time, but went in and interviewed and learned more about Wentworth and got the job. And then that was the beginning of my admission career. That's how it all started.
And I tip my cap to you, fellow Xer, and appreciate the War Games reference. Well done.
I knew you would. I knew you would love that.
Thank you. Thank you. And then you just kind of took off from there, right? You were at Wentworth for
2 years, right? And then I moved up Huntington Avenue to Northeastern University, and I was there for a year as an assistant director. And then at the end of my tenure in Boston, those 2 years at Wentworth, one at Northeastern, I realized, you know what? I really love admissions. I don't think I want to be a professor. I think that this is something that I'm pretty good at and could make a career of doing, and I really like it. Boston as a city wasn't a great fit for me. Wentworth and Northeastern were great as institutions. Just Boston wasn't working for me. So that's when I moved back to the Philadelphia area where I grew up and worked at Haverford College. And I was there for 11 years and had several different roles over there. And that was definitely a point in my career that is very important, learned a lot, got to experience a lot, got to work with lots of other great folks, many of whom are still in the profession. So I was there for 11 years. Then I went to the high school side, was at Friends Central.
I forgot about that.
Just under 5 years doing college counseling, co-director of college counseling. And then after that, I went to Drexel University in Philadelphia, first as director of undergraduate admissions and then dean of undergraduate admissions, and was there for just over 5 years until I left to come here to Ursinus.
Wow. Okay. So there's a bit to unpack there. What called you over to the secondary side? And then what brought you, I don't want to say brought you back, but I guess since you're on the higher ed side now, but explain a little bit about that.
Sure.
I don't want to call it a detour, but that part of your journey.
So at that point, when I left to go to the high school side, I'd been working at admissions for 14 years. I had my daughter, my oldest, was about a couple years old. And so it was really just thinking that now that I was a dad, thinking about coming off of the road and not traveling as much. And, at that point, I was the one who coordinated travel for the office at Haverford, so I could go where I wanted. I was never gone more than a week, but It always seemed like I was gone for a week and then my daughter would do something amazing during the time that I was away. Or at least I thought it was.
Did you miss any of the really big moments, like the first steps or anything like that?
No, but and okay. I can't even remember what the stuff is right now. And in retrospect, some of it probably wasn't amazing. But being a new dad, I thought everything's
amazing.
Was amazing, right?
Everything, yeah.
And you know, and at the time, there was also tuition remission for two children, which was pretty generous. And the school was one of my favorite schools. It was a pretty big feeder school for Haverford, so I knew it through many students that I had met and applications that I had read. So, and also right before that, my wife and two close friends that I'd worked with at Haverford had switched to the college counseling side about 3 years prior to that. So I got to poke and prod and ask them questions about it.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so you had a 5-year run there and decided, let's go back to higher ed.
Yes. So I never entered college counseling thinking that I would like it as much as I liked admissions. Okay. I thought it was the best thing for my family at the time. Maybe about 4 years in, I had an opportunity to work at a university that at one point I considered a dream job, and was actually offered the position, but it wasn't the best thing for my family, right? I was torn about declining, but I had to decline the offer. But it made me realize how much that I missed working in admissions. So then a year later, when I saw the Drexel opportunity come up, that's when I decided that I was going to go for it. And luckily it worked out.
Okay. And then, so just looking at your trajectory, then you were at Drexel through the pandemic.
Yes.
And then said, hey, you know what I want? I want an even hotter seat. Because you finished off as dean at Drexel.
Yes.
And I say that only because I'm laughing with you, having sat in a college that changes lives, VP seat. What made you answer the call to go be a VP for enrollment?
I wasn't necessarily looking for a VP.
Yeah, that's how it usually happens.
I wasn't. And actually, at NACAC, our National Admission Conference, a couple years ago in Houston, ran into Rick Bischoff, VP from Case Western.
And he
asked me, have you ever thought about being a VP? We've been on some committees and some spaces together. And he said, you know, you're really thoughtful and really sharp and care so much. I think you'd be a great VP. And I said, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, he's right, by the way.
Thank you. I said, I don't know. I don't know that I want to do that. And, you know, and at that point, what I knew about being a VP was what I knew from that role at Drexel. And I wasn't interested in doing that there. Being dean at a R1 research school, you know, an urban R1 research school, that was about as removed from what made me fall in love with the profession as I wanted to get. But as I mentioned, my 11 years at Haverford was very formative for me in my career. Mm-hmm. And I'd always thought that at some point I'd love to get back to a liberal arts college environment, and Ursinus being that, and being in the same athletic conference. And I've known many folks that had worked here over the years. So that's what made me start to think about it at that time.
By the way, is there a tornado or something going on in the background? I heard like this wind up air raid siren.
Our building is located right next to a firehouse. So,
okay.
There's an alarm going off now.
Okay.
It's like
it's like an NPR episode with all the ambient sound. It just adds to the gritty realism of it. So before we got on the air, I had asked you a question. Which I will again ask now, but I've been talking to some folks who there are a lot of our friends and a lot of my friends, including you, have ascended to the role of VP recently. And I know a lot of times I talk about on this show, you know, the habits and mindsets and experiences that sort of led to the role. But I'm curious about how to VP, right? Like actually doing the role. And we can acknowledge that this is there's only been a few things going on this year in your first year of the president of the VP role. Sure. With SCOTUS and FAFSA, and I'm trying to think of what any after those enough. Two, everything else. Yeah, that's enough. Like in any year, one of those would be just more than enough. But going from being the dean at Drexel to being the VP at Ursinus, what are some of the differences and similarities? I mean, whichever way you want to go, but what are some of the things that as you're doing the VP role that feel different from doing the dean role that you were doing?
You know, when I was looking at this role and talking to lots of folks, friends and mentors and in the industry, one thing that came up consistently from folks that weren't in touch with each other about this, but folks just kept saying, you know, it's a very lonely role. Being a VP could be a very lonely role. And I kind of understood what they meant, but I had a greater understanding once I started to do the job. I think it's some of the differences. I have a lot more cooperation, coordination, and collaboration with various campus partners and faculty and other administrative offices.
Beyond the office, beyond the admission function.
Beyond my teams, right? And I had some of that as both director and dean, but it's much more extensive now in this role.
Right.
So that's part of it. First time reporting to the president, first time managing an office outside of admissions. So having, in my case at Ursinus, I oversee student financial services, which is financial aid and all the billing as well. So that's been an adjustment and a learning curve as well. And then just having to have equal parts reaction, but also forward vision, right? And balancing all of that out, you know, reacting to curveballs being thrown, you know, like the continual FAFSA delays and issues, right? But also trying to look forward and plan for the future and make sure that you're putting the institution in a really great space for not just next year, but 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road. And, you know, even if I'm not going to be here, making sure that, you know, what I do is going to set up the next person and for success and the college for continued success.
I think that's maybe the first time I've heard somebody describe it that way, like thinking about your successor and setting it up for that person, whoever that may be. That's professionally magnanimous of you.
Well, I think we've all been in situations where you come into a new role and you wish that things were left in a little bit better situation for you, or that you had some information that was left for you that the outgoing person had. And you know, for me, I've never worked for an institution that I didn't feel strong about, that I didn't feel passionate about, that I didn't care about. And usually that doesn't leave just because I may leave and go to a different opportunity. So, you know, I still want, still want the institution to be successful, even if I move on for other things at some point.
Yeah, that's not surprising, but good to hear. I want to come back to something you said before, which is, and I've heard it said a lot about the VP role, which is that it's lonely.
Yes.
What makes it lonely? Not to get all psychoanalytic about it, but sure. For those who haven't been in that role, it theoretically makes sense, but until you're actually in it,
sure.
What does it look like? What does it feel like? And what are some of the things that may make it lonely? And this isn't to wallow in loneliness, but just what characterizes
it's not always lonely, but
oh, no.
For me, I didn't have, so started in January, and then when July hit, our director of admission left, and I didn't have one again until
then. You definitely were lonely
until this January, right? So from July to yeah. January, I didn't have a director.
And, oh wow!
And have a great team. Yeah. Have a great senior associate director who stepped up a lot, but was also new to that role as senior associate director. So just having someone on campus, I felt when Lauren Cicchetti, who's our new director of admission, when she got to campus, I said, I finally have someone else here who speaks my language. I can understand what I'm saying. And that's mm-hmm. not to say that I wasn't supported. There are lots of folks across campus, president and many other folks that have been very supportive, but someone that had done the work, had been a director of admission before and could understand mm-hmm. some of the things that I was trying to do from an insider perspective. I think folks can understand it intellectually, but you know, there's a difference when you actually work in admissions compared to reading about it or even working in other parts of higher ed, but never having actually done the work and done the work at a higher level where you're leading an office. So I think that was, for me, a lot of my loneliness because I just didn't feel like I had anybody else on campus that understood where I was coming from, where I was trying to go, and what I was doing to try to get there until I had a new director.
Okay. Yeah. I remember when I moved into there was no VP role for a while at Lawrence. So I was the dean was the chief enrollment officer. And I remember, you know, I went from June 30th, where I was the director of admission, to July 1st, where I was the dean of admission at the same institution, and feeling like I had somehow, at least the world thought that I was a different person, you know, in 24 hours, ontologically changed is how I would often joke about it. But it's like, nope, I still know as much today as I did yesterday, which is I still got a lot to figure out. What are some of the things, I presume there are some surprises, things that you didn't anticipate when you move from dean director role and into a VP role? Maybe good surprises, maybe less than great surprises, but are there any things that have made you go, why am I quoting CNC Music Factory right now? I have no idea. Gen X.
That's totally a Gen X thing. Surprises. I mean, some of it, you know, I expected a lot of difference because coming from Drexel as an R1 research university, or small liberal arts college, there's lots of differences there. I think for me, you know, it's not really a surprise what I was going to say, but part of the catalyst for me returning to this type of environment was wanting to see and have more of an audience for any of the changes that I put into effect, seeing how they play out. Mm-hmm. And I guess a pleasant surprise related to that would be seeing the more immediate effects of certain changes that we've made. You know, at Drexel, I probably affected more students in 5.5 years than I did in 11 years at Haverford, simply because of the volume, right? Being a lot bigger place, a lot more students to deal with. But I never really got to see it up close and personal there, because there are so many
The scale.
Students, and you're talking about 11 or 12 different colleges, schools, and divisions, and you know, the administrative tasks that kind of pulled me away from the students more than it did when I was at a place like Haverford. And even in the VP role at Ursinus, I've had a lot more student contact than I would have thought. Not always as much as I want, but more than I would have thought. So that's been a very pleasant surprise.
You had mentioned earlier about putting some things into effect that you've been able to see. What are some of the things that you've, some examples of that? It sounds like a job interview question.
It does. And I thought I was through with those.
You already have the job, but no, but I'm curious because you're right. Like when you're in leadership at a smaller institution, the lever you can pull can have a more significant impact more quickly, I think.
Absolutely. So one of the first things I did was we had been a member of Coalition for College in the past, and then it tapped out of it. Yeah. And so I got us back into Coalition for College and up on the SCORE Coalition application platform. So that was something that I was able to do. And full disclosure, I'm on the board of Coalition for College. But, just being able to have the power to make that decision, right, without having to consult right. With anybody else. And, I really appreciated that it was a platform that was designed with access in mind, particularly access for students that may not have all the cultural capital surrounding the admission process.
And right.
It's been a right. great lift for international applications for us. And from my standpoint, I think it says something for those folks that choose to be members of it, as well as those who choose not to be members of it. Since it is not just about the application, but about, what are ways that we can find to expand access to higher education, particularly, again, for those who have the most challenges in terms of accessing higher right. education. So that's an example of something that I've changed. Mm-hmm. We've also been able to, we didn't have any way to collect information from international students in order to award them need-based financial aid. Awarding merit, but not need-based. So having mm-hmm. an instrument drawn up that allowed us to basically mimic FAFSA for international students and seeing mm-hmm. how this year we've already had a decent bump in international students committing. So a couple of things like that where I could just see sort of more immediate effects of changes.
Yeah. Okay. Are you, now that you're in the big chair, one of the wonderful things about it is that you can have sometimes a disproportionate impact, right? I remember seeing other folks do be the chief enrollment officer, and that it comes with a megaphone, right? The role gives you some authority and some credibility to make some sort of changes. I'm curious. It's a long wind up to a question, which is what's something you've been wrestling with in your role? And how does being in the VP seat affect your ability to do something about it?
I mean, the main thing that I've been wrestling with, and we were talking about it earlier, mm-hmm. probably both before and since we've been recording, and of course that's the current state of the FAFSA simplification process. I think that's yeah. what most people in any dean, director, or VP role have been concerned with this year. And some folks have suggested, well, at least everyone's in the same boat, which I don't agree with, right?
Oh, say more about that.
I think it's the same storm. Everyone's in the same storm and beholden to the education department getting its act together and getting all of the FAFSA delays straightened out. But as far as what kind of boat, some people have a big baller yacht. Some people have a cruise ship. Some people have, a Staten Island ferry type boat. Some people have a rowboat. Some people are out there with a flotation raft, right? So how it affects everybody is, as institutions, is not going to be the same. The institutions that are the most well-funded, have the largest endowments, have the highest rankings, have the ability to be super ridiculously picky and choosy. Basically what it boils down to is that the schools that shape a class every year, probably going to be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, they might have to go mm-hmm. deeper into their wait list this year than they'd like to, but they can do it. Whereas the places right. that have to scrap, fight, and hustle to make a class and then worry about shaping, mm-hmm. I think, you know, they're going to be mm-hmm. the places that are going to be the most affected by this. But it's yeah. also, you know, that's bad enough, and there's going to be people in roles like mine and presidents and others that are going to lose their jobs behind all of this. Mm-hmm. There's likely going to be some institutions where they're one short class away from folding, and this nonsense yep. is going to be enough to push them into that territory. And yep. and that's all bad enough, but that's not the worst part about it from where I stand. The worst part about it is, you know, when you know that FAFSA filing is down 30%, and it's only reasonable to think that some of that, probably a large part of that, is because of the initial put back in the schedule and delay, but then repeated mm-hmm. continual delays that some folks are just like, forget about this. I'm not doing it. I'll try again next year. And then that yeah. next year for many will turn into some other reason they don't do yeah. it. Then all of a sudden it's 5 years later, and then they never yeah. end up going to college. And that's mm-hmm. the worst part about it. Not only for those individual students and their families, which that's horrible enough, but who knows how much it's going to affect our country, you know, that there's going to be a dearth of leadership potentially that would have been there had those folks, you know, been able to continue on the path and enter a higher education institution and graduate several years later and then move on to whatever it is that they're going to do. We just, yeah. we don't know how much we're going to lose because of this. So I think it's kind of like COVID yeah. where there's going to be implications that last yeah. for years and years and years, some of which we'll know right away, some of which yeah. we're just going to continue to discover as we advance in time.
That is probably one of the best encapsulations of the problem, or the multiple problems that are attached to this that I've heard. Plus, I love your metaphor. I don't love what it stands for, but your metaphor works of so many different kinds of boats. I worry somebody somewhere is going to tally the economic impact of this debacle. You mentioned earlier colleges closing, because you're right. There are some colleges where the primary competition isn't another school. It's not going to college. Right. And you're going to see some of these institutions probably with even more students opting out and further pushing them to the edge of, if not over the edge.
Absolutely. And those institutions, you know, access institutions are supremely important. You know, those places where it's like you go to college here or maybe not go at all. Because mm-hmm. we know that, you know, even today, when yes, there's more people going to college than ever, but it's still only around 40% of adults 25 and older, and I think 40 might be a little bit high, have a bachelor's mm-hmm. degree from anywhere, right? So just getting a right. degree, completing a four-year degree, you know, if folks need to feel good about using words like elite, you know, that puts you in an elite category, just having a four-year degree from anywhere. And those yeah. access institutions and those institutions that do a lot of great work with relatively few resources, you know, they're going to be the most impacted by this, because financial aid is very likely going to be a huge part of the equation to them building a class.
Right. 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 And not that you can put a cost on it or a price on it, but it's not like people's faith in higher ed is super high to begin with these days. And I worry about the lasting impact that this might have as well going forward. This has turned into the most sunshiny, happy episode of the Alp we've had in a while. But I mean, this is a real problem, and it's dire. And as we're recording, and I'll date stamp it, the end of March. Episode will be dropping in the first part of April, but I'm hoping that things are a little more settled by then. But even by then, I think the recovery, trying to get students back into the pipeline to complete, I think that door is closed for a lot of students.
I wish that I didn't agree with you, but I do. And one of the things that we've been working hard on is pushing out drive to file FAFSA messages. Yep. Because, we know that if the filing is down 30% nationally, we don't know how it's down in our pool. And we also don't know for some of them, like, they may have filed, but we don't know if they did or not yet, because normally we would have gotten the information from the government and we don't have it yet. We've gotten some, we're starting to get some ICERs, which is, the financial aid data, but nowhere near as many as we'd have at this point in the cycle. Right. And we'd normally be processing financial aid packages.
Right.
All the way up until this point, whereas now we're going to have a giant backlog that we have to go back and and process in addition to any new filers.
Oh, yeah. I had Justin Drager on from NASFA a few weeks ago, and he had said, the best thing that everybody can do for their financial aid colleagues right now is support them, give them, give them all the grace they need and get out of their way, honestly, because they've got to do in about 3 to 4 weeks what they were normally doing in about 6 to 8 months.
Exactly.
Just the compression and the pressure, but somehow it'll get done when it'll get done. But also, I wonder about the toll that it's going to take on folks. This might be a good time to ask the question, and I don't know where the answer is going to go, but I occasionally ask the question about the superpower, right? Uh-huh. which is, you wake up to discover that you've been given 24-hour access to a superpower that can only be used to affect a lasting change in higher ed. What would you do, Michael Keaton?
I like
as Birdman.
I like the question as someone who is not particularly enamored with superheroes and superpowers. I don't think I've seen a single of the Marvel Universe movies, but I love this question.
You're not missing much.
I figured it's just great for people who like them, but probably not for me. But I love this question. I think what I would do, I can only do one thing, right? I would make it so that every college and university had the same amount of money in terms of endowment, and that they all met full demonstrated need. So that now every school could be on an equal playing field in terms of finances. And then we could take a look at, all right, well, everybody has all this money. How are they using it for the benefit of their students and for the education of their students, and just kind of putting everything on a more equal playing field and allowing students to focus more on fit and removing the financial piece out of that equation of fit.
Could you imagine how much fun this job would be if that were the actual case?
It would. I mean, I can imagine there's, I have some friends at a few places that might not look at it as much fun, because I think there'd be a lot of places that aren't quote unquote fancy or elite. They would look a lot more like some of those places that are if they just had the kind of money to throw around. But I think it would be, great for, many institutions. It certainly would be an amazing thing for prospective students and families. And I suspect that we would see more folks seeking out higher education if that were the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, may it happen. I don't know if it's going to happen, but man, wouldn't that be a great fantasy world to live in?
Ken, if the past 4 or so years have taught me anything, it's that anything is possible.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Welcome to the show. Hey, before I get into the rapid descent questions, I do want to give you a moment, when you think back on your own journey, and it's been, you've had a lot of places, you've been able to be with a lot of people at a lot of different places and have a lot of different experiences. Are there folks that have, in particular, who have lifted you along the way that you want to give a shout out to?
Absolutely. Delcy Phillips, former dean of admission at Haverford College, who hired me back in 2001. I had 3 years of experience at that time. And I remember her saying to me, I don't know if she would remember this, but she said, well, you've learned about recruitment and now we're going to teach you about selection. And there were some really great lessons that I learned from being on that team. But most of all, you know, even more than anything about the business, was just having someone like Delcy, who was a very, very knowledgeable, very skilled, but also very caring, very considerate of the folks on her team. And, you know, I didn't know, I learned a lot that I didn't know I was learning at the time, but looking back, I could see how she protected the team from certain things to allow us to just, so I could focus on giving a dynamite admission information session or doing my travel or reading, and just, I could kind of worry about that stuff, and having someone who's in charge of an office take care of the other things so that we could focus on what we needed to do.
Oh, I love that insight. That's really, that's useful. Thank you.
Absolutely. So she was great. Jess Lord, who came in after Delcy at Haverford, and like Delcy to this day, is a dear friend and colleague. But just again, observing, and you know, they're both very different personalities than me, so I couldn't do everything the way they do it. But I kind of like to take bits and pieces of their style and incorporate them in ways that fit with me being me. Jess, very involved with the intellectual dimensions of our work, and very diplomatic, very measured, one of the most intelligent folks you'll ever meet, but also fun, you know, creating an environment where we're going to do lots of hard work. We might as well enjoy each other's company and have a good time while doing it. So definitely the two of them. And then Evelyn Thimba, who hired me at Drexel and is now at American in DC, but just also watching the way she moves and hearing about her experiences and thoughts and viewpoints, and kind of having the opportunity to partner with her on some things, but also to, you know, watch her in action. I think those are, when I think of folks that have had a tremendous impact in my career, there certainly are many others, but those are the first names that pop into my head.
Oh, that's great. Good for you. And good on them for helping shape. I mean, and that's the thing. You think about all the folks who you carry with you into your own leadership role, and the little turns of phrase or things that you find yourself saying that you heard back when you were earlier in the career. And it just, the intergenerationality of what we do can be a profound thing.
100%.
All right, sir. Are you ready for the rapid descent?
Let me take a deep breath. Yes, now I'm ready.
All right, put on your helmet. We're going down. Let's fast. Do it. All right. What is your walkout song?
Oh, well, it was Eye Against Eye by Bad Brains. That was my one at Drexel. Then I switched it up to Spanish Castle Magic by Jimi Hendrix when I got here. You know, Jimmy's my number one guy. Oh. But I have to have a new one for this year because it's a different kind of year. So for this year, when we have our admitted student day in another week, it's going to be The Boss by James Brown off the Black Caesar soundtrack, because the refrain is pay the cost to be the boss, and I'm feeling that more than ever this year.
That's perfect.
Had to be the song.
So will you actually play that when you walk out?
Yes, absolutely. I actually just sent it to my team today. They were asking me, what's your walkout music going to be? And that's what it's going to be.
You know, God, I never did that. Like, never actually played a song when I'd walk out on the stage for an open house or whatever.
Well, Ken, that was one of those things that mentioning Evelyn from Drexel, we never really did that. And then these admitted students days, there would be, you know, in the basketball arena, really big events. And I said, I want my walkout music. I want theme music. And
hype it.
She, you know, she, I think, probably thought Bad Brains song was crazy, but she let me be me. You know, she knew that
that's cool.
That's Mike. So I'm going to let Mike be Mike and do his thing.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. All right. Let that be a lesson to everybody. Actually, use your walkout song. What's the best thing you've read lately?
So I am currently reading an almost finished a young adult fiction book called The Black Kids by Christina Hammonds that I bought for my daughter. It's about young African-American wealthy girl in L.A. During the early 90s, right after Rodney King and during the riots, and attending a private school and navigating all the race and political strife and social issues. And, you know, that's our time as Gen Xers. So it's been a really great read that, again, I'm still working through it, but almost.
Okay.
But it's been a
good.
I'm enjoying it.
Good. What's something you're eager to read next?
So it's not out yet, but I have it on pre-order. It's called From Punk to Monk by Ray Capo, also known as Raghunath, who was the lead singer of Youth of Today, a legendary 80s New York hardcore band, and then Shelter, which was a Hare Krishna hardcore band, hence the name of his memoir, From Punk to Monk.
It
comes out next month and will be delivered to me April 9th or 10th. So I'm looking forward
to start the countdown. Awesome. Great. Great recommendation. What's a podcast you particularly enjoy?
My favorite is a Philly flavored one. It's called Broad Street Breakdown, or Vinnie Paz Presents Broad Street Breakdown. Vinnie Paz from the rap group Jedi Mind Tricks. It's him and a couple of childhood buddies. And it's really, it's not a hip hop podcast. It's actually more of a punk rock, but also just culture and current events and with a Philly flavor. So that's my favorite.
Nice. What's your favorite thing to make in the kitchen?
Well, I am coming up on being a vegan for, it'll be 3 years next month.
That's right.
So I always liked cooking, but had kind of gotten out of it for a while. But being vegan got me to more excited about experimenting with new recipes. And right now, one of my favorite things to make is vegan chopped cheese, which any New Yorkers would know. And I'm a Philadelphian, but the chopped cheese is sort of like the cheesesteak in Philly. That's like sort of the New York bodega sandwich. So I like making those with Beyond or Impossible meat and and my proprietary blend of spices and seasonings.
I'll ask about that offline. What do you use to take and keep your notes?
Interesting question. I use a Kindle Scribe. And I actually just lost my stylus for it today. But another one is already ordered and on the way, but I'm loving it. Our president and a few other VPs use a Remarkable tablet.
Yeah.
And I felt like I can't get that. Everybody else has that, but I wanted something. So I went with the Kindle Scribe, and I'm loving it. It's been about maybe a little less than 2 months and it's been great.
Okay. Good tip. I've been thinking about making that move because I like the physicality of writing, but I don't like the unsearchability of having it on paper.
Exactly. So it's that. Yeah. And also, you know, not using a ton of paper that is going to end up getting thrown away. So.
Oh, now you made me feel bad. Okay.
You put a lot of good into the world as well, Ken, but we all have room for improvement, right?
Your footprint is small, but mighty. What's a memorable bit of advice you've received?
Don't start none, won't be none.
All right. From?
Multiple people, but my wife is definitely one of them.
There we go. Okay. Question last. Name an item on your bucket list, presuming you have a bucket list, that you haven't yet checked off.
I don't have an actual list, but I've thought about this. There's 11 states that I have yet to visit, so I'd like to be able to say that I've visited all
okay. States. Is Colorado on there? Because
I have been to Colorado.
Dang. All right.
I was there earlier this year, actually.
Okay. Well, next time. I'm out here now, so. So 11 states, do you care to mention what they are? Because people may want to just invite you and take care of you.
Hawaii, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Mississippi, North Dakota, Michigan, Montana, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Wyoming. I think that's 11.
Sounds like somebody needs to get out to the Midwest.
I have been to the Midwest. Actually, my last College Horizon was at Lawrence University.
That's right.
2008. I have been to Appleton, Wisconsin, Ohio. Certainly been to Ohio plenty of times, Minnesota.
Let's see if we can crowdsource the check off, put a pin in every state in the map for you.
Well, your reach is vast. So hopefully somebody listening to this will reach out to me.
To my dear friends in Idaho, please get them up there. All right. Michael, it's been great catching up with you again. Thanks for making time. I know there's a lot going on at this time of year. I hope this FAFSA thing resolves itself as quickly as possible and as wholly as possible. But I know it's never going to be as fast or whole as we want it to be. But hang in there.
Well, thank you, Ken, for the invite. And it's also been great catching up with you. I think that we all need to be more intentional about pausing and making sure that we reach out and reconnect with folks from time to time with all the spare time that we have. But I'm glad that we had occasion to do so today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I will close as I always do by saying, Michael, may all your big dreams come true, at least the good ones. And to you, dear listener, thanks for listening. Be well and do well.